Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, Dr. Martin Luther King said he looked forward to the day when we Americans judged people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Is America moving closer to that day? And what does the election of Barack Obama tell us about Americans' racial attitudes? We'll find out more. My guest, John Powell, is professor of law at The Ohio State University and director of OSU's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. John Powell, welcome back.
Good. Nice to be here, Fred.
We're at 614-292-8513 and open line at WOSU.org for your emails. John, are we moving closer to the day in which we judge people by the content of their character rather than their race or ethnicity?
I think generally, yes, although it's a little bit more complicated, as you might imagine, than that, because we basically understand people very differently than we did in the 1950s and 60s. There's a whole thing called implicit bias, for example, that sort of looks at how people make associations with people based on race and gender that they're not even aware of. But we've certainly made tremendous progress, and President-elect Obama really captures that in part. The danger is that we then say we're done. And we're not, because the way racial inequality actually happens in the United States is not simply a question of individual judgments. It's affected by this thing I called implicit bias, but it's also affected by institutional arrangement. I just read a report this weekend that our schools are increasingly segregated both by race and class throughout virtually every American city. So we have that, and it's not even on the radar screen. We have that at the same time that we have the election of Barack Obama for president. Mm-hmm. You look at our prison system, which continues to get worse and have huge racial inequality, even for the same crime. So it's not like people say, well, black people or Latinos commit more crime. And so in a way, this can lull people into thinking we're done. And if anyone doesn't make it today, it's certainly their fault because anyone could be president. And it's not and that doesn't really explain how race really works in the United States.
Why is it that schools are getting more segregated?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, there's a woman named Iris Young who's an American philosopher. She died a few years ago. And she basically made the observation that as society becomes more complex, more and more of our lives are mediated through structures and institutions. To give you – and that may sound like a lot, but it's quite simple. Think of where you get your food. You don't see the farmer. You don't go out to the farm. You go to a store, and the food's been packaged, and you're five steps removed. Think about if you're trying to find out who owns your mortgage. You get on a phone, and you call, and you talk to a computer. And if you can talk to a real person, the person tells you got the wrong person. So our lives are structured through these institutions. And one of the major institutions is our housing institution. School is another institution. And these institutions are structured in such a way that they reproduce racial inequality. They reproduce actually negative racial attitudes. And so we live in segregated communities. And the last part of the Civil Rights Plank was the Fair Housing Act, which happened in 1968. And George Romney, who was one of the early Secretary of HUD, he basically said you can't solve the housing problem unless you open up the suburbs to all people. And Nixon said that's not going to happen. And no president has reversed that. Mm-hmm. So our housing policy still have the undergird of the way it was structured in the 1950s and 40s.
So Americans of different races and ethnicity live in different neighborhoods and don't come into a lot of contact with one another. And schools tend to be neighborhood schools.
That's right. And the exception is the South. The South tends to be the most integrated school system in the country. And the thing to remember, Brad, is that this wasn't always the case. Most people say, well, that's natural. People want to live by themselves. Before the 1930s, first of all, most Americans lived in the city. And you may not have liked the people who lived across the railroad track, but you could see them. America was physically close together. The restructuring of America's housing market cost hundreds of billions of dollars paid for by the federal government. And literally, the highway system, the mortgage system, the credit system all created a pathway for whites to leave the city. And at the same time, for blacks and to a lesser extent Latinos, there was slum clearance, which created giant high-rises. So the structure of our housing market was heavily the federal government and state government and local government was heavily involved in it. It wasn't a matter of personal choice. And Americans, for the most part, have a hard time dealing with things at a non-personal level. They think everything can be reduced to – but think about the subprime crisis that we're facing right now. It's no one individual's fault. But the reality is blacks and Latinos are two or three times more likely to have subprime loans and have bad loans and face foreclosure. And it's not because of the individual action. It's because when we created the housing market in the 1930s and 40s, blacks and Latinos were locked out. So there's a lot to this. But when you fast forward to the 90s and they're looking for new markets, the new markets are the black and Latino communities that are still racially isolated, but the banks don't quite know how to loan to them. And so half the loans that the black community got should have been market rate loans. If they'd got market rate loans, they could have serviced those loans.
Mm-hmm. Why couldn't they get the market rate loans? What?
Well, part of it is that people were unfamiliar, and it's sort of like, well, we don't quite know. And it's actually interesting. It's not just black and Latinos. It's anyone living in a black and Latino neighborhood. And these neighborhoods have been redlined since the 1930s, which is a program instituted by the federal government, which basically said if you had an integrated neighborhood, it was not safe, it was not stable. And even if it looked good today, it was going to change tomorrow. So the federal government actually encouraged banks to redline and said, if you want us to insure your loan, you have to give this community a poor credit rating. And that's never been
the federal government says.
The federal government, yeah. These are federal programs.
But wasn't something called the Community Reinvestment Act a while back, which said, look, you know, to banks, you must make a certain percentage of your loans in poor neighborhoods.
No, what the Community Reinvestment Act says is that when you get ready to do something, like if you get any other activity that requires either merging or buying a bank, then you go before CRA and they see if you've made loans in the community, not a certain percentage. There's no and that came about in the 1970s, and it's been a good thing, basically. And, in fact, people have seen that what they call CRA, Community Investment Act loans, have actually performed on par with regular loans, but it's small. It doesn't really begin to deal with the subprime issue.
But those loans you say have performed on par with regular loans,
right?
Because we've had some callers call the show and say, look, this whole prime mortgage mess is due to the loans that banks were forced to make under the Community Reinvestment Act, and they were bad loans, but they were forced to make them. But that's not true.
Yeah, it's not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the reports, I mean, it's actually interesting, you know, because so we have this global meltdown. And what do people – and this is part of the cultural thing. So we have this global meltdown, and the first reaction is, well, it's those people, you know, forcing to loan to those people and those people performing badly. And that has a racial tinge.
Yeah.
And this goes back to your earlier question. Are we getting to a place where we judge people by the content of character? And it's not that simple, because that's what people call symbolic racism, is that we associate certain things with black people, with white people, Latinos, which is not the same as being racist. And you can actually flip associations. But the data is very clear. CRA did not cause the foreclosure crisis. And in fact, in many ways, they call them also predatory loans. Many of the loans that went to the black and Latino communities, there were some bad loans, no doubt about it. There was a big push from Wall Street to make loans without documentation, without any money down, because there was so much money to be made. The amount of credit in the world doubled from 2000 to 2006. There was trillions of dollars looking to make loans, and they made bad loans. But a number of the loans they made, first of all, had nothing to do with CRA. Secondly, the pressure wasn't CRA. The pressure was Wall Street. It's like, we can make money. And they were saying to the banks, forget about documentation. You know what? Because housing is appreciating in value, the worst that could happen is the borrower can pay. If it was CRA, it should have started in the 1970s. It didn't. It started recently when loans became securitized. It was really Wall Street and the market that actually caused this, and it set on top of a segregated pattern of housing that already existed.
John Powell is professor of law and director here at Ohio State University, the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. This is 614-292-8513 to call into Open Line or email at openline@wosu.org. John, you mentioned symbolic racism, and you mentioned assigning certain characteristics to certain groups. Tell me a little more about that.
There's something called the Harvard Implicit Association Test, and you can go online and take it. And it's not just for race. It's basically people make associations based on race, based on gender, based on age. And those associations are not personal. They are social. So one example will be they'll show – there's one test they use where they flash something very fast, and they flash a person with a gun. And you're supposed to identify if the person or not with a gun or without a gun. And you suppose if the person has a gun, you're supposed to shoot them.
This is on the Internet. Yeah, you see these pictures flashing at you. You have to decide whether to press a certain key to shoot them or not. Right.
And people incorrectly shoot the black person and incorrectly let off the white person.
They may or may not have a gun. You have to identify quickly image whether they do or whether they don't, and then you have to decide whether to shoot or not.
Right, exactly. And they have things like that for gender and things like that for language. And basically, it's faster than the conscious mind can actually process it. And these are social phenomena. In other words, if you're in a society where Muslims are disparaged, then people in that society, not individual prejudice, and even people who have liberal views toward race have these same kind of association. Even blacks have negative association toward blacks in a country where blacks are disparaged. The thing that's interesting, Fred, is that we're conflicted. So publicly we have this move toward egalitarian concerns, but subconsciously or implicitly we still have negative racial associations, in part reflecting the reality that we see. You know, when you look on television and you see who's being arrested or you see someone who's poor, we build up these negative associations, and then there's this cultural story that explains, like the subprime, how quickly we move to it's those people who took out the bad loans.
Yeah. 614-292-8513 with Charlie. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. I have a question. Barack is biracial, but yet he considers himself black. But if a Caucasian has Native American blood, they're normally very proud of it, but they still, you know, consider themselves Caucasian. And I wonder why is that?
Interesting. A biracial columnist for the Washington Post this weekend said, you know, Barack Obama is not black. He's biracial, she said, just like me, meaning the columnist. So we're erring in calling him a black president.
Well, Fred, the thing is that people talk about race being socially constructed, and the way race was socially constructed in the United States is that if you had one drop of black blood, you were black. You were not part black. You're not biracial. This is a new phenomenon. And the reality is something like 75% of African Americans have at least 25% quote-unquote white blood. You know, we're cooking the books. Most people know the case Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the case that said blacks couldn't ride on a rail car with whites, which ushered in Jim Crow. What most people don't realize is that Homer Plessy was an octoroon. He was 7/8 white. But people didn't say he's not really black. The Supreme Court said you're black. You can't ride on a car. That's the end of the story. And the thing is that race is constantly being redefined, and it's being redefined in such a way as to in a contested way. That rule, in turn, the one-drop rule, didn't apply to Native Americans. If you had one drop of Native American blood in you and you were white, you were still considered white. If you had one drop of black blood in you and you were otherwise white, you're considered black. So these are historical legacies and really the sort of hostility toward blackness that wasn't extended in the same way. I'm not saying there wasn't hostility extended toward Native Americans.
So it seems like it's just more the color than the culture, because I think Native Americans were treated worse than black people.
Well, it's different. The thing is, it's not color, though. Color, you know, like I said, Homer Plessy phenotypically was white. If you look at even our laws and the Constitution, they say race and color because they're two different things. And we're not really very precise. Race is something we think about a lot. But the laws, I mean, give you one example. Until fairly recently, 1967, many states made it illegal for people to be married interracially. It was against the law. And because states change the legal definition of race every 10 years, sometimes two people would be the same race, and then they change the definition, then they'd be an interracial relationship and be breaking the law, the same people. So race is actually very complicated, and yet it has been used as a way to distribute social meaning. For example, one of the first acts of Congress was to say you could not become a naturalized citizen of the United States unless you're white, period. And there's a case in the 1920s where there was an Asian American from India who had been living in the United States and working with his family. He was a successful businessman. And he decided to become naturalized. And they said, no, you can't become naturalized because you're not white. He said, what do you mean I'm not white? I'm a Caucasoid from India. I'm the original white person. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court said, in everyday language or in India, you may be considered white. In the United States, you're not considered white. You cannot become a naturalized citizen.
I'm going to listen to the rest of your show. I thank you so much.
Thank you, and Charlie.
Just to finish that story, he committed suicide.
Yeah. What does... does the election of Barack Obama say anything about America's changing racial attitudes? I mean, you know, some people said, well, there's going to be the so-called Bradley effect, where white people who told pollsters and maybe told themselves that they'd vote for a black candidate when they get in the booth aren't going to be able to bring themselves to do it. But it doesn't seem that that occurred.
Well, that's right. And Fred, you and I talked about that previously, and I think you remember I said, you know, people were talking about the Bradley effect. That was 30 years ago. Mm. The things they should be looking at now is implicit bias, and I hope it doesn't take us 30 years to understand implicit bias. We've made progress, but I guess one of the things I want to emphasize is that we should not overstate it. And so what we have is sort of this binary. The binary is either we're stuck and we haven't made any progress, so we're just like we were in the 1950s and 60s, or we're in this racial Shangri-La where race no longer matters. Both of those are extreme positions are wrong. Race is actually very complicated. And it's the way it's actually – the importance of it in terms of today is increasingly the way that we structure our institutions, the way that we structure our policies. One of the examples I like to give is that – think about Social Security. Think about retirement and unemployment insurance. When the United States adopted these rules in the 1930s, and the rules haven't been changed substantially, when they adopted these rules in the 1930s, they defined work in a certain way. There were three categories of work that didn't count. One was if you were a domestic worker. One was if you're a farm worker. And the third was if you stayed at home and took care of your kids and your family. Those three provisions saying that's not real work, so the Social Security and unemployment and other benefits that arrive from the federal government does not cover those three types of work. That was blacks and Latinos were knocked out by domestic and agricultural worker. Women were knocked out by staying home, taking care of the children. And now even though women work in the formal workforce, they still don't get Social Security benefits because they're in and out of the workforce, and they call it the mommy track. What's the daddy track? That's just regular work. So what I'm saying is that our policies themselves have racial and gender implications. And it doesn't mean that someone necessarily thought, how do we punish blacks? How do we punish women? But people are sensitive to certain things and insensitive to other things.
Mm-hmm. Step back a little bit. Let's tell me a little bit more about implicit racism. What does that mean?
Well, implicit basically, I mean, there's a whole literature on this. There's a book called The Political Brain by a friend of mine named Drew Weston. There's another book called The Political Mind. Basically, we know, for example, in terms of memory, there's actually a thing called implicit memory. You know, you say, someone say, do you remember that? You say, no. They can show that your body actually does remember it. So you don't consciously remember it, but there's a part of you that does remember it. They've actually had examples where a doctor may come in and give some procedure to a patient that's very painful when the patient is knocked out. And then the doctor comes back in the room, the patient reacts to him. The patient unconscious has never even seen the doctor. And so what implicit bias basically means is that and these are social biases, we have associations that we're not consciously aware of. Now the good news is the reason implicit bias is important is that we are conflicted. We have a conscious egalitarian space saying race doesn't matter, every person can do what they want to. And then at the same time, there is still implicit racial resentment. Mm-hmm. Both of those things are happening at the same time. And when a person says, I'm not racist, they're not lying necessarily. The Bradley effect was when people lied, essentially, when people told the pollster they're going to do one thing, but they knew they were going to do something else. Implicit bias, basically, it says a person doesn't know. And the thing that's really fascinating about it, Fred, is that you can do things to make one form of a network more active than another. To give you an example, you say the Call Me Harold ad that was run when Harold Ford was running for senator of Tennessee.
African-American, and it was a white woman saying, Harold, you know, dressed very provocatively, saying, Harold, give me a call. It was a 30-second political spot. Yeah.
Interesting. You say dressed very provocatively. The picture of her, she was not dressed at all.
Uh-huh.
And that was part of the implicit. You were so – this is a naked –
In other words, you saw what?
You saw a crop, and you can go online to see it if you type in on, mm-hmm. on the Internet, Call Me Harold, it'll come up. But the crop was – from the chest up, no clothes.
Bare shoulders. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, bare shoulders. And the mind is processing that this is a naked white woman and this black guy's after. And the whole idea is to activate, what they call activate racial resentment. Now, you can also activate positive racial stuff. So when you talk about Nelson Mandela or when you talk about Rosa Parks, it activates positive things in the same person. And so people have conflicting feelings. Conflicting networks, and what advertisers do, what politicians do, what is tried to activate. So I'll give you another example. When John Kerry and President Bush were running, and Kerry would get close in the election, Bush would remind Americans that there were terrorists out there and that we should be fearful. He was activating what they call the fear network, because that network, certain things happen. Well, the same thing is true in terms of race. There's certain networks that are more dominant than others, and there's a lot of racial resentment, and that's what partially what symbolic racism is. That's partially what the Southern strategy was. So when Nixon talked about law and order, when Reagan talked about the welfare queen, it all had this racial tinge to it. And the thing is, now we can measure it with almost exactness. I mean, we can actually see pictures of the brain and see when this. So it's so we know a lot about it, but it hasn't gotten into the public discourse very much yet.
So if there is this indeed implicit racism for a society that wanted to move beyond that, you know, would it be a process of making it explicit in some way and so that people could deal with it? I mean, how would you go about that?
Well, there are a couple of things, and I don't call it implicit racism, implicit bias. Mm-hmm. They're not the same. Because like I said, many people, I think racism, the word racism per se is overused. Of course, most people don't realize the word racism is only about, you know, 80 years old in the U.S. in English language. Racial hierarchy is much older. White supremacy is much older. But racism and the concept has a history, so it's constantly changing. And what I'm saying is that one of the things you would do, you elect Barack Obama as president. That helps because if it interrupts the assumptions that we make, that we implicitly make, it's actually a helpful thing to have. Oprah Winfrey actually helps. To have a woman teaching in front of a math class actually helps. So these cultural phenomena of implicit bias, in some ways, are reflective of what's actually happening in society. And that's why I'm talking about, you know, but having segregated schools don't help. Having this huge disparities in prisons don't help. Having stories that the CRA is the cause of the subprime crisis don't help. So we have conflicting stories out there. Having these games on these video games where you have extreme stereotypes, all the blacks and Latinos are criminals and crooks on these mm-hmm. video games don't help. So there's these conflicting messages that people are getting and the conflicting reality. But part of it is what you're saying is people becoming aware of it. For the first time, if you go back and look at some of the news media, there were a number of stories about implicit bias for the first time in the United States news. But also we have to be very careful to look and see what our institution, the work they're actually doing, and not just focus on attitudes, because we might say, you know, I don't care if someone's black or white or Latino, but the policies we adopt maybe have huge racial implications. And I'll just give you one. Think about the three big bailouts. We have Wall Street, mm-hmm. we have foreclosures, and we have automobile. Now, the reality is how the mind processes it. Wall Street, New York, what do you think about? The reality is it's white. And in fact, it is white. It's overwhelmingly white. Sure. It's overwhelmingly male. They've gotten the biggest buyout with no strings attached, and they were at the heart of the meltdown. Like, as I said earlier, they caused the foreclosure crisis, not CRA, not the individuals borrowing. Wall Street caused it. Then you go to foreclosures. Again, disproportionately black and Latino. Some help, but, you know, with some verbal beating up at the same time.
And not a lot of help either.
And not a lot of help. Yeah. Then you go to UAW. Here we have union workers, working class, many blacks and Latinos and poor whites, working class, and we're beating, you know, we're just killing them. I mean, it's like they can't do anything right. Yes, they flew there on private jets, but those people in Wall Street have private jets, not for a company, but for individuals. We gave them $350 billion with no strings attached. And I'm saying, I'm not saying they're the same. I'm not trying to equate them. But I am saying there is a racial overlay that actually affects the way we process information.
All right. John Powell is professor of law and director of the OSU's Kerman Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. We're going to take this break and then be back with my guest and you callers at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most. The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock. And coming up on today's edition of Talk of the Nation, we're going to be talking about national security and reviewing the choices Barack Obama makes for his national security team. That's all coming up on Talk of the Nation beginning at 2 here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Are you hungry for more than headlines and short sound bites about our community? Watch Columbus on the Record for in-depth, thoughtful, and balanced analysis of the issues and stories affecting Columbus and Central Ohio. Columbus on the Record is on Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on WOSU TV. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, occasional snow showers mixing with some rain throughout the afternoon. A snow accumulation of snow and rain mix could be around an inch, and steady temperatures around 37 degrees. Tonight, cloudy skies and snow showers are likely. There is a chance of an additional inch of snow tonight and a low of 28. Currently 36 degrees in downtown Columbus. You're listening to Open Line on WOSU 820. NPR News. And now, back to Fred Anderle.
Welcome back to Open Line to WOSU 820, NPR News, 614-292-8513. Again, we're talking about racial attitudes in the United States, attitudes of implicit bias, among other things. And John Powell is back with us, professor of law at The Ohio State University and director of Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, 614-292-8513, or open line at WOSU.org with Mary. Hello, Mary. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I guess my question has to do with Arab and Muslim. And I consider myself, you know, fairly liberal and unbiased and all of that. But after 9/11, I find myself looking at people that I think look Muslim or Arab with a fear underneath, sort of them, mm-hmm. of what happened. Were they involved somehow? And so, you know, it's kind of, to me, it's kind of unreasonable to look at everybody as a group and say they're all bad, but how do I get around this?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think, you know, in a sense, you're doing the right thing. I mean, all of us have bias. I mean, bias is human, and all of us stereotype, the sort of false sense that we can be rational. I mean, some neuroscientists say that our rational mind represents about 2% of that. Actually, the rational mind is actually motivated and energized by the emotional, and yet we have very little access to it and try to deny it. And so part of the thing that they do is exactly what you're doing is first of all, make ourselves aware of it, and not just cognitively, but otherwise. And then there are things, which they call debiasing things, that we can do. And it's easier to have bias when you're separated from people, when you don't know any Muslims. And, of course, you talked about Muslims and Arabs. You know, as you know, Muslims and Arabs are two different people. Muslim Correct. Is a religion. Arab is a people. Mm-hmm. And they are very different. And in this country, we lump them together. And so in a way, we need de-biasing techniques. We need to find out more about the history of Arabs and Muslims. It would be great. There are more Muslims in the country now than there are Jews, but we have very little contact with them. We know very little about them. And what we get, we largely get from the media. And there are extremists. There are extreme, dangerous people out there, but they're not all Muslims. They're not all, and they're certainly not all Arabs. There are dangerous Christians. There are dangerous Jews. They're dangerous agnostics. So part of it is how we process information. But I think there are de-biasing things we can do. But the first thing is to become aware, without shame, without beating ourselves up, that we do have bias. And one of the dangers is that, I think we should be celebrating Barack. I mean, that's really an amazing thing about him, but more amazing about America. But we shouldn't go to sleep because we still will have biases and we still will have issues to deal with.
I guess on an individual level for Mary, I mean, first of all, as you point out, John, you know, Mary's aware of her bias and potential bias. And it's not easy to get to know someone who is Muslim or someone who is Arab and Muslim or someone who is Arab. I mean, if that's possible in the community to do that, because as we can live so separately, but to get to know somebody, I think is and to have a conversation and talk with them, even one person might be a good way to overcome some of that.
Well, that's certainly true, and certainly even reading about it. I mean, if just reading the history. I mean, I've had conversations with people, and they're amazed at the history of Arab countries and certainly Islam. I mean, it's interesting, you know, when you think about there are three great Abraham religions, Judaism, Christian, and Muslim. They all come from the same family. They all have these common roots, as opposed to Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism. And so there are reasons that – so part of it is reading, part of it is studying. But part of the thing that you're dealing with, Mary, is that you're dealing with something that's a cultural phenomenon. And that's the point I want to keep making, is that implicit bias doesn't mean I just have bias. It means, more likely, bias is really in society,
the whole culture,
and we're affected by it.
Yeah.
But we can do things about it, but first we have to recognize it's there.
Mary, what do you think?
I understand what you're saying. I think, you know, you talk about the 98% emotional and the 2% rational.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very interesting figure. Might explain a lot. But, you know, when you mention Muslim being an Abraham religion.
Abrahamic, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say 98% of the people in this country have no idea of what you're saying. You know, I mean, they're that far removed from any knowledge of Muslim beliefs.
Well, like I said, John, that's where the reading comes in. That's right. Where the understanding comes in.
And leadership. I mean, you know, if you have leaders that really help, because leaders do affect us. I mean, whether they are cultural leaders as mm-hmm. well as political leaders. So I think we
need more leaders.
Religious leaders. And the message we get after 9/11. From our leaders was at best ambiguous. You know, we started doing really religious profiling. And even though we said we weren't attacking Muslims, there was this drumbeat about these dangerous Muslims out there. I do think we have been – the world is changing. We have people coming to this country, people traveling all over the world. The world is much smaller. And so we're going to have contact with each other. It's very important that we have sort of a knowledge base for this contact to be mm-hmm. civil.
And also another thing that happens, I think, too, is there were numerous Muslim organizations, both locally here in Central Ohio and nationally and around the world, that absolutely condemned any kind of 9/11 attack or any sort of suicide terrorism, condemned the kind of thing that happened in India this past week. Mm-hmm. But they didn't get a lot of coverage from the media.
No, they didn't.
Yeah,
and think about the presidential election that just happened. I mean, one of the drumbeats that you heard was Barack Obama's really a Muslim. I mean, implicit in that, right, it never was said, implicit in that is that he's an American, he's dangerous, he's, you know, the obvious response, which Colin Powell actually made,
yeah.
was, first of all, he's not a Muslim. I mean, he's getting beat up for having, for Reverend Wright being his reverend. They don't have reverend.
And for his middle name being Hussein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so he's getting beat up for being a Christian, but he's also getting beat up for being a Muslim. And the assumption is, if you're Muslim, you're dangerous. And that was implicit. You know, it never was said. I mean, but no one ever could say Barack Obama personally is dangerous. You know, but they're saying he has dangerous friends. He's a Muslim. He has a dangerous religion. And a lot of that was also about race. And it was very good. It was very important. Very late in the campaign when someone finally came forward and said, what if he were a Muslim?
This was Colin Powell. Yeah. Well, so what if he was a Muslim? He said the right answer is that that's an honorable thing to be. And he wanted to give an example on Meet the Press of a young Muslim who'd given his life, an American citizen for this country in Iraq, and named him. And that was an important thing to say.
Right.
But how do we bring the media to bear? I mean, how do we influence the media to give a more balanced look at life, at stories, and how they report them?
Well, that's a great question. I think, first of all, it helps when people like yourself are sort of asking for that. But secondly, and I want to say that I think the media is starting, but the media tends to be sensational. You know, they say if you look at NewsHour, it's all death and destruction, even if there's not a lot of death and destruction in the world, because that sells, that's caused the ratings to go up. So in a sense, they're giving Americans what Americans in some level want. But I think I do hope with Barack in the White House and more people speaking out that it'll start having a resonance with America. Examples of Muslims who are clearly very patriotic Americans. Those people have to be lifted up. Those stories have to be told. And that would be a wonderful project to just talk about Muslim, Christian, Jewish relationships in a positive way, not just in a negative way.
Yeah, and I think, Mary, you know, a lot of work has to be done within the media by, you know, reporters themselves, by editors, by talk show hosts, by people who write columns. You know, we've got to work on our own attitudes and work in-house. It's not going to all come from outside, for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks,
okay,
Mary.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. And here is Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Fred. Good
morning.
Good morning to your guests as well. I want to ask... I've had some serious discussions, both in person and on, message boards, with some very intelligent individuals who seriously are advancing the idea that with Barack Obama's election, racism has now magically been eradicated and purged from the American body politic, and that one person quotes, Hoover fellows Shelby Steele, who suggests blacks should take responsibility for their own disproportionate crime rates and poor academic performance and not blame a system imposed upon them by whites, that whites support affirmative action and other silly racial policies out of fear to avoid accusations of racism, and that this must end and blacks cannot progress and that the barriers have been removed. So I want to ask your guest is the election of Barack Obama, which is, of course, a watershed event for both black people in particular and the country in general, is it going to be used as a club, something people can use to rationalize away their the lingering racism or their own personal prejudices?
Well, I think, you know, and I know some of Shelby Steele's work, and Secretary Bennett, right after the night that they announced that Barack had won, he said, all right, no more excuses. You know, blacks can do anything. I don't want any more excuses. You know, so you're going to have this debate and over the next several years, really, as to what this means. And what it means depends on what we do. Some people will try to trivialize race to then dismiss it. So they'll call race and racism, unless you have a Confederate flag and a hood, they're saying there's no racism. And what I'm saying is that race and racism is actually very complex. It's not just a psychological event. It's a systemic cultural event. And as a psychological event, it's not just a conscious event. It's also an implicit event. We don't understand that very well. And sometimes we're so anxious to get beyond race that we fail to really come to grips with it. When Brown v. Board was decided, Thurgood Marshall and thousands of other Americans basically said, in 10 years, racism will be over in the United States. This was Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it was different, but different doesn't mean over. And Thurgood Marshall, as you know, died 40-something years later, having been a Supreme Court justice with a broken heart as he watched schools resegregate throughout the United States and his work being undone. And so racism was not over. Judge Carter said, I misunderstood what racism was. And part of the thing is racism is not a thing. It's a process. It's a complicated process that gets lodged in our institutional practices, gets lodged in our housing patterns, gets lodged in our culture, and gets lodged in our mind. But it changes. And so Barack said it best. He said, this is a historic – people say this is a historic moment. He said, really, it's an opportunity to make history. We've had – and we make history by actually in participating. But you're going to have people like Shelby Steele. Now, Shelby was saying this before this election. You know, so this was just, you know, he was just retooling something he had been saying forever. He's always been against affirmative action. It's interesting. And this is not his field. I mean, his brother is Claude Steele, a friend of mine who is head of the psych department at Stanford and studies race. Shelby Steele was an English professor at San Jose State. But the press pushes Shelby's work because he says what they want to hear black person say. So we have to be very careful that this is an incredible opportunity, but it's not an opportunity that will happen on its own. And there will be people who will try to use this to beat up on blacks or Latinos. And again, it's this false dichotomy. Personal responsibility, certainly personal responsibility is important. I have children. I teach them that. But it's also we live in systems. What about the personal responsibility for people now who happen to have bought a house and the house is declining? We don't say, well, that's a person, you know, you live in a neighborhood where the home values are going down. You took out a student loan and you can't get a job. We don't turn to that person and say, it was your stupid decision to take out a student loan and go to college, and if you can't get a job, we shouldn't help you. So this personal responsibility is we use as a club. Mm-hmm. Of course there's personal responsibility, but there's also social responsibility. There's also societal responsibility. We need to look at all of it.
If I ask one quick follow-up, is that – so are you saying then that the best way to point to maybe counter this out is that maybe that the personal selection progress of one individual to get to the highest elected office in the land does not necessarily translate to every – you know, to 30-some million black people as a whole.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, but we have a number of examples of this. We've had women who have been head of countries all around the world, and one day maybe that'll happen here in the United States. But think about countries where women are mistreated or, you know, don't have the same civil and equal rights. You know, Pakistan. No one would say having a woman head of state ended the issue of women in Pakistan. There was actually some. And so it's laziness on our part to think that one person is laziness and misunderstanding. Race and racism is complicated. It doesn't rise and fall with the life of one person. Mm-hmm. But the office of president is not a small office. It's a huge office, not just in the country but in the whole world. So it's an opportunity. But it's an opportunity for us, not just for Barack. But, you know, you have to look at there are a number of states that actually went more Republican than in the last two elections, and some of them were clear that it was about race. So the country is in this very conflicted place about race. You have incidents of racial hostility going up, not down. You have countries, you have states talking about seceding from the Union, so they don't think it's over. You have some conservative Christians saying, if you voted for Barack, you should ask God to forgive you, or you're going to hell. I mean, so the country's in a very fluid place, and I hope we will continue to, as Lincoln said, our better angels will come out, but we have to work at that.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for your call. Yeah, the CNN, or I should say the Chicago Tribune, rather, reports that headline, Obama's victory sets off surge of bigotry, a spasm of noose hangings, racist graffiti, vandalism, and death threats convulsing dozens of towns across the country as white extremists lash out at the new political order. Yeah. John Powell is professor of law at The Ohio State University, director of OSU's Kerman Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. An email from Jim. Could your guest address the perception that some blacks think that doing well in school is, quote, acting white? Will the success of Barack Obama change this so that academic success is more broadly acceptable in the black community?
Well, there's a guy named Agbu who's done a lot of work on this, as well as others. And there has certainly been, in the last 30, 40 years, some black students in particular, who are basically have some anxiety about being or acting white. And so you sort of try to be just the opposite, whatever you define white as being. Not with the same degree, but you have some whites who have a similar thing, you know, where white kids are attacked for acting black. I think that Obama's election will help that. And again, the point is, it won't do it by itself. There have always been very smart blacks and successful blacks. But the point is, I guess, is that there's now someone who people can emulate. And you're already seeing things. I've talked to young blacks who had dropped out of school who said they're going to go back to school. And you hope that as the dust settles and they go back to school and they run into problems, even in their own life or in the school system, they can sustain. But I do think we have to do things to make it really obviously, quote-unquote, cool to be academically smart, not just to play basketball or to play sports. I do think it's pretty cool that we have a president or a president-elect who the way he relaxes is to go play basketball rather than golf or tennis.
Okay. It's Alice next. Hello, Alice.
Hi. Let's see now. Maybe I'm calling with a lot of thoughts on my mind.
But keep it brief because we're running out of time.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay. And maybe you can give me a little bit of counsel as to what you think of my thoughts. I have, over the years, I've had a lot of Muslim neighbors, and I've always approached them as though they were American neighbors that were moving in, just going to them with a cake or whatever to just become friends, and I've had a lot of success in that I've made lifelong friends. I've helped them adjust to American ways. But yet, they are still very different, and they hold to that. I grew up in New York City, where I grew up with a dozen different cultures around me, and usually when they come here, they're open to adapting more to our ways, to American ways. I'm not saying if that's right or wrong, but except maybe the Hasidic Jews in New York City always really, really kept to themselves, and they remind me most of Muslims that I'm meeting here. I guess my question, my statement, and maybe you can counsel me on this, is that something that bothers me or worries me about Muslims settling here is that it just seems like they would be so much happier back in their own country, and I'm sure that's where their heart still is.
Well, we have to keep it brief. I have to say, John, my experience in meeting Muslim and Arab citizens here in Central Ohio has been very different. That they seem to have, if we're going to use the word assimilation to American traditional culture, they seem to have done very well with that. They're doing very well economically. They're very open and accepting, and I've had a very different experience, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the old melting pot, which came out in the 1930s, which was really about Eastern Europeans coming to the United States and the demand that they assimilate and melt into the American culture, has actually shifted. Part of the thing was that they were coming from a long way. They had very little contact with their home country anymore. Today, people travel all over. The world is changing very fast, and of course, a lot of Muslims are not coming here. They're here. I mean, they're born here. They're born Americans. The Muslim congressman is a friend of mine, Keith Ellison, from Minnesota. He's an American, born an American. So even the notion of people coming, part of the thing is that there are some boundaries. There are some American values that we want to really be careful about, but those values are going to constantly be evolving as people come, and whether it's Latinos, whether it's Arabs, whether it's Brits, whether it's Germans, and if they've come here or born here, you know, the idea of them going back to their country, I mean, to me, that doesn't make sense. I mean, the world is not like that anymore. Like I said, a lot of those people, this is their country. And that's part of the thing. You see, if you go online, you see this, a lot of people saying about Barack, go back to your country. It's like, what do you mean, Hawaii? I mean, it's a funny concept.
Alice, thank you. Got to move on. And to our next caller, Susan. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I heard your conversation about the integration in schools did not work, and I guess I missed, I don't understand. Well, obviously it didn't work because we're still at the same spot. At any rate, since the 70s, I have thought that the best way to really promote equality would be to bring teachers from different, who are the other, let's say white, into black schools and leave the children in their own communities, but bring the teachers in who are of the other race or the other, Muslim or whatever, to come in. And because a teacher to a very young student just becomes a real hero and a person to be respected. And I think that that respect is the thing that is missing from the equation, that we don't feel that we can respect people that we're afraid of. And if you were not afraid of your teacher and you realized that your teacher was someone totally different from you, then from early age you could cultivate understanding. How would you feel about that? I mean, I still think that that is the case now. We still need to do that.
Well, two things. I'm certainly having a diverse teacher corps. The reality is most teachers in the United States are white women, and so most black students actually do have white teachers. So that and I don't think it's produced the outcome entirely that you suggest. But in addition to that, when Jefferson, who was our progenitor of public education in the United States, his idea was prepare people for citizen, prepare people and you don't teach people to get along in a deep way by keeping them separate. And even the idea of their own community. Again, as I suggested, these communities were constructed by the United States government. These weren't people self-constructed. And finally, I wouldn't say integration has not worked. I say we haven't tried it, especially we haven't tried it outside of the South. And in the South, for the most part, it has worked. And the resistance to it, frankly, is more likely from a segment of the white community than from black Latinos.
Mm-hmm. Susan, thank you. Time for a quick question from Rod. Yes.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple quick comments. Basically, I wanted to get your opinion on the fact that we have school vouchers and that you don't see a clamoring for school vouchers in the outer suburbs, where they can afford to have nice schools. And also, there was a story on the BBC earlier about people, that want to become French citizens, having to be functional in French. And maybe this could be extended the next half hour or whatever, but, at what point, what is an American, and at what point do we start to lose our identity as a nation?
Well, two things. In terms of vouchers, yes, you're exactly right. The vouchers, there is not a clamor for vouchers or for charter schools in the suburbs. It's really trying to fix a problem, and it's all those things should be tried, but they're, in a sense, they're avoiding the elephant in the room, is that we still have deeply unequal schools, funded unequally, and racially segregated, especially outside the South. I mean, we've had relative success in many parts of the South, though we're starting to lose that. In terms of the French culture is very different than ours. I mean, this society was built upon the idea of inclusion, even though it was imperfect, idea separation of church and state. I don't know if we want to use, I love France, but I don't think we can use that as a model for us. What does it mean to be an American? To some extent, it means being part of a polyglot. It means part of a pluralistic democracy with a separation of church and state. So I don't think I would be concerned if we went to the French model of if you're going to be French, you got to assimilate. I mean, that hasn't been. We could look at Canada, which has a much more deliberate multicultural society, and it seems to work fairly well.
Mm-hmm. So in the final, less than a minute, sorry, callers, that we couldn't get to everybody this hour. It's a complex situation involving institutions, individual mindsets, implicit bias, all these things. We've got a lot to work on here.
We do have a lot to work on. But I think we should celebrate. But then once we finish celebrating, we should continue to work. I mean, there's a continuum. There are the whites who want to succeed from the union, and there are whites who interact very comfortably with blacks. There are blacks who don't want to have anything to do. There's a continuum. So even when we talk about race, we have to complicate the discussion a little bit. But we are making progress, but we're not there. And if we're going to get there, we have to do the work.
John Powell, director of OSU's Kerman Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Fred.
Back after the news at listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus. We're streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.